American Broadway. Big, black, and queer ass American Broadway.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. A Strange Loop won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2020 following a successful off-Broadway run. Now, just a month on Broadway, it's nominated for 11 Tonys, the most nominated production of the year.
How many minutes till the end of intermission? Is that how the show should open? Should there even be a show? No, it should start with what he's thinking, which is just a cursor blinking because of all of the directions that the narrative could go.
The play is about a queer black writer named Usher, who's writing a show about a queer black writer, who's writing a show about a queer black writer, who's writing a show about a queer black writer, hence A Strange Loop.
Till the end of intermission, no one cares about a writer who is struggling to write.
They're saying it's way too repetitious
and so overly ambitious.
I spoke with playwright and composer Michael R. Jackson about his groundbreaking musical, which tackles themes of queerness, race, religion, and AIDS. With humor and heart.
Queers on the daily.
All right, so this is quite a labor of love. 18 years working on this show. That's like the amount of time it took me to raise like a human.
I know, it definitely is my baby.
So tell me a bit about what it took to rear this little human up to the Tonys.
Yeah, so I started working on A Strange Loop when I was about 23 years old. I had just graduated from undergrad at NYU playwriting, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I had a BFA degree. What did I do with that? The U.S. was about to go to war with Iraq. I was living in this little old lady's bungalow-style house in the middle of nowhere, Jamaica, Queens. I was just very uncertain of my place in the world, and so I began writing a monologue that at that time was called Why I Can't Get Work. Mm-hmm. And it was just about a young black gay man walking around New York City, wondering why life was so terrible and sort of meditating on different areas of his life and the world. And from there, it just began to evolve as I went to grad school and started writing songs. And then the song started to go into the monologue, and then sort of the loop began.
I almost hate to ask it, but is it your story?
I always sort of try to be clear with people that this story is emotionally autobiographical. I often use the term self-referential, mm-hmm. which is to say that I have felt everything that the protagonist, Usher, has felt, but the events of his life are not always or even necessarily a one-to-one ratio of events to my life.
Is the audience there for you when you're composing and when you're writing? Are you thinking about how it's being received, or is the audience secondary for you?
I'm always thinking about the audience, not in the sense of like trying to please them or to pander to them, but into trying to pull them into the story. So I'm always like thinking like how to make sure that they understand what's going on, and how do I put them in the case of this show, into Usher's brain, because that's sort of where the show takes place. And what tools do I have at my disposal to kind of draw them in and allow them to experience a piece on their own terms.
So I am into explicit language. I tend to curse in the middle of Zoom meetings on, and especially when the meetings are on Zoom. I curse like a drunken, angry sailor who also has a toe injury, right? But I'm wondering, as you're talking to sort of about the ways that you're allowing the show to meet folks where they are and for your audience to have this full experience, did you get any resistance around the language in the show? Maybe more specifically, Second Wave, because that song is doing a lot.
Because the second wave feminist in me is at war with the black gay man who's not...
Yeah, that's one of the songs in it that was started off as a standalone song that I just sort of wrote for myself. And then it found a home in A Strange Loop. And it's just one of the moments in the show where Usher is sort of like freeform thinking through how he feels in the wake of like going on all of these sort of like Grindr scruff apps kind of thing and looking for love in all the wrong places.
My Michael, so wait, I just got to go back to something you said there. So you said it found a home in the show, but you actually initially just wrote it for yourself. So like when you're just like walking around the house, like what, doing the dishes, you're singing these lyrics. I mean, that's pretty intense, son.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'd like to swear to, I'm a language first kind of person, and I think all words are beautiful, and you arrange them in a certain way to convey an idea. And if it hits, it hits. And I sort of, I'm like kind of a truffle pig in that way. Like, is the idea really going to pierce through, you know, the sort of the veil?
The show references many times Usher's inner white girl. I often say I'm at war with my, used to be my inner Becky. Now I guess it's my inner Karen. And it's just
a friend of mine has a term called Karens of Color, which I think is funny.
So what is Usher's inner white girl?
Usher's inner white girl is essentially sort of women, sort of singer-songwriters that he really admires, who through their art are expressing themselves in a multitude of ways that he really relates to emotionally. Not necessarily in saying, like, the song is not about like how he wants to be a white woman or anything like that. It's just, it's like that there are these women who have this music where they get to be sort of emotional and wild and unwise and sort of have a range of emotions that he feels as a black man that are not necessarily afforded to him, you know, by the world at large, but that he in his work is trying to express, to show sort of like a nuance of self.
White girls can do anything, can't they? Black boys must always obey their mothers.
White girls... And specifically, sort of the women that he points to in the show are Liz Phair, Tori Amos, and Joni Mitchell.
And you just got to meet Tori Amos. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was really incredible. There was something that got set up through, like, our general manager knew someone, and they knew I was going to the concert anyway. I'd already bought a ticket for the first night. And then when it turned out, because we were trying to see if we could get her to come to the show while she was in New York, but she didn't have time. But they said that she'd be willing to speak to me if I came to the show. So I asked them to get me and a couple of my friends who are also big Tori fans to go backstage to meet her after the show. And it was truly magical. It transported me right back to my 15-year-old self, who was like super angsty and just coming out and questioning religion that I'd been raised with, and all kinds of things that Tori speaks to so beautifully and in a complex way and in a profane way that was very exciting to me in her music as a 15-year-old who was both sort of coming out as a person but also coming out as an artist.
We have to take a quick break. More with playwright and composer Michael R. Jackson just ahead here on The Takeaway.
Amber Ruffin has been a black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with you now on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're speaking with Michael R. Jackson, the playwright, composer, and lyricist behind A Strange Loop.
Unleash my hungry lion, 'cause Dorothy's had enough of toxic Tyler Perry.
One of the show's principal antagonists is none other than Tyler Perry, the actor, director, producer, and self-made billionaire, who's of course the creator the popular Madea franchise. Perry's work hangs like an ever-present cloud over Usher's artistic and professional landscape. His mother's favorite creator, whose work represents a mainstream black identity that Usher rejects. I'm not even going to lay this out as a question. I'm just going to say two words.
Okay.
Tyler Perry.
Tyler Perry. Yeah, what about him?
Well, I believe that in many ways you and I likely share a similar assessment of Mr. Perry's body of work, that despite his often being held up for his...
As a table maker.
Yes. That maybe neither one of us are that excited by the things that he creates and gives for us to consume.
Well, so I feel like whenever Tyler comes up in regards to Strange Loop, I feel that it's really important for me to be very clear with people about it. I do not have a personal grudge against Tyler Perry at all. He's been very nice to me, you know, over text. He's called me. He's congratulated me on the show. The thing that I actually am sort of trying to get at is, like, I have issues with his work. And I actually think that it's worth it to talk about it. I think that, you know, a lot of times with Black authors, like, because there's so much scarcity around, like, when and where our work is seen and how much of it is there and is there enough of it and blah, 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 that we don't spend a ton of time actually talking about it. And I feel that Tyler Perry has an audience. It's an audience that loves his work. My mother is devoted to his work. And I think that that's valid. But I also think that it's valid to be able to talk about the flaws in it as I see them. It sort of all began for me with his work, really, when I went and saw the film Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor, because there's a lot of content in that film that sort of, in my view, very irresponsibly deals with the issue of HIV/AIDS. And that's something that, you know, has touched the Black community, has touched people that I know. And it really came to my door in 2019 when a dear friend of mine passed away from AIDS-related complications, in part because of a lot of the ideology that I feel is sort of touched upon in a film like that. I'm not laying all of that on his doorstep, but I did feel that in addition to that, I just wanted to talk about the work. And I actually think that makes it stronger, because I'm taking him seriously. I'm not one of these people who just goes like, oh, I'm snooty, you know, bougie Black, who, oh, that's not how we do things. That's not my take on it. Like, I love lowbrow things. I am Real Housewives of Atlanta and Beverly Hills all day. And there's many references to the Housewives and A Strange Loop. But I'm just kind of like, people say that his work is like real life. That's something I've heard people say. And I just was very struck by that, because I feel like I know some of the things that he's getting at, but the execution of it is often so one-dimensional that I'm like, why are Black people being depicted in this way in this world and being celebrated in this way? I mean, maybe it doesn't matter, but I just, you know, as an artist, as like a critical thinker, I think it's worth it to talk about it. But that being said, he's been very nice to me, so...
Right. Let's stay with that. Okay. I have just two more. One is, you've talked about the profane. Talk about the profane and the sacred at the intersection, and where your work is challenging us at the intersection of the sacred and profane.
Oh gosh, that's a deep question. I don't know. Wait, what do you think? I don't think I have an answer to that.
I know this
you're
is...
stumped me. I'm usually good at on the stump, and I'm like, I'm a little gagged by that. I don't know how to totally answer that.
For me, I feel like you are you're asking us to reimagine what constitutes the sacred, and that you're pushing back against these kind of very narrow, let's call them religious definitions of the sacred, and opening us up to a really, I would say, a more fully realized conception of it, and that we sometimes have to carry our profanity into that space to find sacredness. But I don't want to put that in your mouth. That's just like me critiquing out here.
So what that makes me think of is that, like, toward the end of A Strange Loop, there's a song called Memory Song where the refrain of it is, all those Black gay boys I knew who chose to go on back to the Lord. And then it changes to, and one lone Black gay boy I knew who chose to turn his back on the Lord instead.
All those Black gay boys I knew who chose to go on back to the Lord. Not one lone Black gay boy I knew who chose to turn his back on the Lord.
And then that's followed up by a song called, by the title song, A Strange Loop, wherein he sings, maybe I don't need changing.
Maybe I don't need changing. Maybe I should regroup. Cause
change. It's just an illusion.
Just an illusion. Just an illusion.
And both of those songs have a kind of, I didn't realize this until like I was watching a couple previews and listening to the music and watching it with the audience, that they both have a kind of almost Christian rock like vibe to them. but the songs are this kind of celebration of the self as holy, as being sort of, you know, as we say, as said in the Black church, sort of not blessed and highly favored. What's that expression? That
oh, yes. Blessed and highly. It's, how you doing today? Blessed and highly favored.
It's blessed and highly favored, but there's another one that says fearfully and wonderfully made.
Oh, yes.
That Usher comes to sort of see himself as fearfully and wonderfully made, but he can't get to that place of sort of transcendent selfhood and spirituality without sort of going through the gauntlet and going through the fire and the crucible of all the sort of organized religion that he's raised with, and the sexuality, the degradation, all of that leads him, like, you know, sort of through the wilderness of self, like 40 days and 40 nights. And so I do think there's a connection there of the sacred and the profane, and where Usher ends up by the end of it. And that certainly has been, you know, my experience having been raised in the church and like hearing a lot of negative things about being gay, and but also wanting to get to a higher place, and art being the thing that helped me get to a higher place of feeling sort of a spiritual place. And so, you know, the theater and making theater is sort of my holy place. But it's also the place where I get to be profane.
Michael R. Jackson, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Then what a strange loop.
The original Broadway cast recording is available on June 10th.